thanks for the introduction. It's good to be back in this room. I guess all of you know that memory corruption attacks are real, and they have a long past. In this talk, we're going to work through the different kinds of memory corruption, what kind of paths an attacker can follow to exploit a memory vulnerability. And we'll also look at what kind of different defenses have been proposed in the last 30 or 40 years of software development. And we'll also discuss why most of these defenses can be circumvented easily in just a couple of steps. So all these memory corruptions actually led to an arms race between attackers and defenders. And in the movie War Games, that you see in the background here, we are told that the only winning move is not to play. But well, we are hackers, right? So maybe we can change the rules of the game to actually win, nevertheless. And we'll see how we can do that later on. So to start off with some numbers, to convince you that memory corruption is actually a real thing, if you just look at vulnerability classes according to the list of common vulnerabilities and exposures, on the x-axis we see the years from 99, when the data collection was started, to last year. And we grouped the different kinds of vulnerabilities according to a set of factors. And we see that there's just like a ton of attacks out there, even though we've been rolling out defense mechanism after defense mechanism after defense mechanism. And academia has proposed like 200 different defense mechanisms that are out there that haven't been adopted yet. And we'll also look into why these mechanisms have not been adopted. So this memory war, or this war in memory, is an ongoing war. And the problem inherently lies in the way how we write software. So low-level languages like C or C++, they trade type safety and memory safety for potential performance that you can get. So all the checks that are executed during the runtime of the application are completely in the control of the programmer. And the programmer can add or remove checks at his or her convenience. And well, a problem is that often these programmers forget to add these checks, and this will lead to a whole set of bugs, in addition to all the other high-level bugs that exist in the software as well. And also, there's a large set of legacy code and new applications written in C and C++ that are prone to memory bugs. Let's just look at the Google Chrome browser, a big software project that has just been started a couple of years ago. It's written in a kind of stripped-down version of C++ that's very close to C. And it gets owned like 4 to 6 times each year. And that's supposed to be high quality code that has been just started a couple of years ago. And that clearly shows that we have no way how to get around that problem and how to fix it right now. In addition, there are way too many bugs out there to find and fix manually. There's way too much code and so many bugs out there that we need some additional services and defense mechanisms that actually contains these bugs. So it's still a very valid approach to actually go find and fix the bugs that are in there. But it's not feasible to protect the security of our systems by just fixing these bugs one after one, because it would take way too much time. We need an additional approach that protects running software from attacks, even in the presence of bugs in the software. And we'll look into that as well. So let's start with memory corruption, the root of the problem that we are facing. And Andreas actually gave a very good talk a couple of days ago. Was it yesterday or 2 days ago?
2 days.
2 days. Who's seen that talk? OK, about a third. And he gave a very good introduction into memory corruption. And he told us that the only winning option would be to recompile all our software with an extended C compiler that adds all these type checks on top of it. Well, all this stuff comes with an additional price tag of like 250% performance drawback. So that might not be as feasible and if you want to compile any regular code. So in this section, We're going to follow the same motivation like he had, and we're going to introduce memory corruption, but using a more formal approach. So we systematize these memory corruption into a model of for memory attacks and define security policies on top of that model that helps us classify different defense mechanisms according to this structure. So memory corruption on a very high level is an unintended modification of a memory location due to either a missing or a faulty safety check, type check, or anything like that. So the programmer forgot to add something that prohibits an attacker-controlled input to modify some of our internal state of the program that might lead to some other follow-up corruption. And I've shown a couple of lines of C code in the bottom that shows a vulnerable function. And if the user is able to supply a specific value, the user can leave the bounds of the object that he or she is supposed to access and write anywhere into memory. And this is the core of any attack action that uses memory corruption. This bug is only exploitable if the address or the value is dependent on input. So if the attacker can craft a path from the beginning of the execution where input flows into the program to the actual instruction that does the memory access. And the attacker therefore sees all memory, and we assume that the attacker can control all writable memory using such an approach. So what is let's split this memory corruption attack into two different types. The first one is a temporal error, where we have a small vulnerable function, and at the beginning of the execution of the function, the pointer still points to the correct object, and we run into a temporal error. If we free that object, which is perfectly fine, but later on, if we access that object, then we get a memory corruption. And this could lead to some, maybe the memory allocator allocated some other memory in the background or some other object, and we can use that bug to override that part of it. The other possible memory error is a spatial error. So something is, a pointer is moving itself. The other one was a temporal error, where the pointer is no longer here due to some change constraints during the execution of the program. And this one is that the pointer itself moves along. So initially, the pointer points to a valid data point. It's used to write something, and it's updated. And later on, the pointer no longer points to the exact same object, but to a different one that is no longer valid, maybe some bound information or anything like that, that can then be overwritten with the bug. And if that's attacker controlled, the attacker can use that as a first step to start the escalation process. So this is at the core of every attack. But what happens afterwards? So to discuss this part, we're going to look into the dominant attack vector that's used in these days for any software attack that you see. Control flow hijack attacks are very common and basically the only or the biggest attack vector that's used today. And we'll look into the security policies and the defense mechanisms and follow each step that an attacker has to do to accomplish a control flow hijack attack, given an example. So on a high level, we have a control flow graph with a set of basic blocks. And the control flow flows from one basic block to the other. So let's assume it starts with the first basic block and then goes to the third basic block. But now let's assume at the third basic block it ends with an indirect control flow transfer. And the attacker is able to modify the code pointer that is used for that indirect control flow transfer somehow. So maybe the attacker can override an address on the stack, the return instruction pointer, or override the target address for an indirect jump or for an indirect call. Using that approach, the attacker can redirect the control flow from a valid control flow graph to a different part of the application that would never be reached otherwise. So the control flow of the software leaves the statically defined control flow graph and enters a new state that would not be reached otherwise, which can be used to bootstrap something that's called or is called a weird machine. And then the attacker can reuse and continue to reuse existing code, for example, using return-oriented programming, jump-oriented programming, or any of these other code reuse techniques. Or even, like in the old days, inject new code if there's a page with writable and executable permission. So on a high level, I want you to walk through a control flow hijacker attack step by step and discuss the capabilities that an attacker actually needs to have to carry out the attacks. And we'll then use these capabilities to discuss the different defense strategies one step after the other, so that we can see how we can refine and define different security policies after each other. So let's start the execution. Let's assume we start the vulnerable function, and we jump into that, and we open up a new stack frame on the bottom. We start executing this vulnerable function, and we've allocated the argument to the vulnerable function on the stack, the return address, a saved base pointer, and the compiler made space for the temporary array. As soon as we hit the vulnerable string copy function, the code starts copying data from an attacker-controlled buffer into the stack array and might override the other addresses. So if the attacker-controlled input is small enough to fit into the buffer, we don't care and everything is fine. If the attacker continues to write, we reach a memory safety violation, which is the first step that the attacker needs to be able to execute. So at this memory write instruction, the attacker needs to have the capabilities to circumvent the memory safety check. So there must be a missing check somewhere, which is the very first stack. As we continue in the next step, the attacker needs to circumvent the integrity of the code pointer itself. So only if the attacker can override the code pointer and is allowed to actually override the code pointer, the attacker can continue with the attack. And in addition, the attacker actually needs to know with what value he or she needs to override the code pointer. So if the attacker doesn't know where the location of the system function in this case is, the attacker will not be able to succeed with the attack. And as the execution continues, we will reach the return instruction, and we'll reach the next step. At the return instruction itself, the attacker needs to have the capabilities to actually execute the indirect control flow transfer with a new target that would otherwise not be reached. And only if the attacker can circumvent all these checks, or if these checks are missing, then the attacker will succeed with a control flow hijack attack on a high level. So all these steps are necessary for an attacker to succeed with an attack. So if we want to use return-oriented programming, we need to have all these capabilities, and we need to have all that information to actually run it. And on the other hand, a defense mechanism can stop the attack at any of these steps. As long as the attacker doesn't reach the bottom of the graph, the software is fine, and the attack is not successful. Until recently, a very popular attack vector was code corruption, where actually code was rewritten. And I've actually read papers about that even nowadays, even though any processor or any CPU that I'm aware of nowadays has read-only permissions and executable bits that can be used to restrict the writability of memory pages. So code, an attacker can no longer inject code directly into the memory space of the application. So this attack is actually no longer a problem, but was the big attack vector until the mid-2000s. So to close that part, the most common attack vector is our control flow hijack attacks that reuse existing code inside the image of the application. And code corruption attacks are no longer that much of a problem. And all the attacks that we've seen in the beginning on the motivating slide are basically code corruption attacks. So what kind of defense strategies have been proposed against these control flow hijacking attacks? What's out there? What can we do at each individual step? So on the first step, on the memory safety step, we can actually stop the memory corruption from happening. So we can look at each individual memory read and memory write if they violate some memory safety properties. And like Andreas mentioned as well, there are safe dialects of C and C++ like Secured or Cyclone that actually enforce additional properties for each memory access. The drawback, of course, is that you need to rewrite your software in this new language or need to constrain it to follow that pattern. Or you can retrofit, you can change your compiler to add these additional checks automatically with a possible performance degradation by using the softbound and CTS approach. So in general, enforcing memory safety is considered to be too expensive. If you want memory safety, you could actually rewrite the software in a type-safe and memory-safe language like C or C, like Java or C Sharp, which would be much more convenient to, instead of rewriting it in a language that supported arbitrary memory accesses in the first place, and more natural that way. So rewriting in a safe language is the safest option, but well, we still have this large set of legacy code, so we should look into a defense strategy that's actually feasible. If we go to the next step, we can enforce the integrity of a large set of read and writes. So there's a large set of code pointers that's out there, and we can enforce the integrity of just code pointers by restricting it to specific security checks that are added either on the compiler side or at one part of the runtime side. So there's write integrity testing that checks all the different memory writes and checks them according to a points to graph that's determined at compile time. And there's, of course, data execution prevention and writable XOR executable for code, which is kind of an integrity check for just the code pages itself. The next step are probabilistic defenses. You can shuffle around all that stuff in memory and hope that the attacker will not be able to find out what kind of where the locations of your code are. If the attacker doesn't know where to jump to, then he or she will have a hard time to succeed with the actual attack. And as a last step, there's flow integrity, for example, control flow integrity or data flow integrity that protect control flow transfers from one code location to the next one. So data flow integrity checks where what kind of buffers or what happens on a high level, and control flow integrity only looks at the indirect control flow transfers. And we can add defense mechanisms at each of these steps. The hottest currently discussed defense mechanism in academia is control flow integrity. So I want to go a little bit more into detail how this defense mechanism would actually work. The idea behind this defense mechanism is that you restrict all the control flow transfers to a statically determined graph of valid control flow transfers. So at compile time, you run a points to analysis, and you check, you get a statically determined control flow graph. And at each control flow location, you check if the target is in the set of valid control flow transfer points. So let's say we are at the end of basic block 2, as shown on the slide. And according to the static control flow graph, we have two possible options where we can jump to. At runtime, we add an additional check and see if it's either basic block 2 or basic block 3. If it's a different basic block, we can stop and terminate the application with a memory or with a control flow integrity violation and say that the attacker modified it somehow. But unfortunately, all the current implementations that are proposed, and there are about 20 different implementations of control flow integrity out there right now, all these implementations over-approximate. First of all, due to the static analysis at compile time, which is inherently imprecise because it doesn't consider runtime information or dynamically loaded code. And in addition, to cut some corners and to get enough speed, they only have one set of indirect calls, one set of valid targets for each indirect calls, indirect jumps, and return instructions. So again, if you're at the end of basic block number 1, we see that according to the check, any of these basic blocks would be a valid transfer point. And the check would only ensure that you target actually a valid basic block, but it would not ensure that it targets the only single one valid basic block that would be determinable via the runtime information that you have. So what are the limitations and the drawbacks of these defense mechanisms? First of all, the precision is limited to the static analysis. All this imprecision leads to ambiguities and other problems that you need to circumvent by adding a whole bunch of other stuff or losing precision. And most implementations choose to lose precision and end up with just one set of possible valid targets they enforce for every single possible targets. Another problem is that the static analysis must see all the code at the compile time. So support for dynamic libraries and dynamic loading and all that stuff becomes very challenging. So most CFI solutions will not support shared libraries that are loaded dynamically at runtime, which is kind of a showstopper for current software. On a regular Linux system, you cannot even link the libc statically anymore. You have to link it as a shared library. Yeah, they dropped that support a couple of years ago. And you're faced with a decision of either having performance overhead or additional imprecision in that area. So the current implementations all choose to have over-approximation and loss of precision and end up with roughly 5 to 10% performance overhead. So this is currently the hottest alternative for a defense mechanism because it already constrains the control flow just to the basic blocks that are out there. But it still has some drawbacks. And maybe we can get a finer notion of where we can set up new defense mechanisms that are more precise than this approach and actually have lower overhead because it's always kind of a compromise. But let's summarize the different paths from the memory corruption down to the successful attack in a more general model, which allows us to classify the different attack and security policies. So again, we have our control flow hijack attack that starts with a memory corruption. First, the attacker has to control the memory corruption, then circumvent the integrity of the code pointer itself, circumvent the randomization and know the locations of code in the process image, and then circumvent the control flow integrity checks at the indirect control flow transfer itself. Another kind of attack that we quickly discussed is the code corruption attack that fits into this model as well, if the attacker just modifies the code and the randomization of the code layout. But we also have a large set of other attacks, namely data-only attacks that do not modify any of the other control flow data structures or the code itself. So we can actually copy all these boxes on the left-hand side to the right-hand side, and we can look into an attack that modifies data and data and needs to know the locations of data and data location pointers and the data flow integrity as well, which kind of combines all the different steps and paths the attacker can take to reach the bottom to actually execute some bad behavior. And the data-only attacks are actually generalization, as code can just be seen as a subset of the data. And the code pointers are a subset of the data pointers. So the data side is the harder problem of the left-hand side. And if you look at data-only attacks, the attacker is only able to modify part of the heap or of the stack and inject data values there that are then interpreted by the application in a different way. And these attacks are very simple but powerful. So imagine that the attacker is able to control the isadmin variable on an FTP server or something like that. The attacker can use that approach to change the control flow of the application, but by just changing the value of the data itself and not changing any of the code pointers and circumventing code pointer integrity or anything higher level like that. And using just such a simple change in memory, the attacker can already circumvent many of the other checks. But we'll see more about this hard problem later on. So what kind of defenses are actually deployed out there? What is the state of the art? How far have we come in the last 20 years of research and defense mechanisms? Well, only a few of those have seen widespread use. And we'll look at each of those individual defenses and see how it handles different forms of attacks and how it fits into this model of attacks that we just defined. And we can then see at which steps there's still something missing that we might be able to add on top of it. So the first and strongest protection that's currently in place is data execution prevention, which enforces the integrity of code on page-level granularity at all times. It's basically a hardware extension that adds an additional bit in the page table that tells us, or tells the CPU, if the stuff that is on that page is actually executable or just data. And we can enforce, by the loader and the kernel, writable XOR executable pages, so that a single page is either writable or executable, which mitigates against all the code corruption attacks, like dropping your shell code on the stack. That's no longer possible if the stack itself is not executable. And the nice thing is, it has very low overhead, like 0%. It's hardware enforced, and it's widely deployed. So, but unfortunately, it has limitations as well. So for example, it doesn't support self-modifying code or any dynamically generated code. As soon as you want a JIT compiler, like for your JavaScript engine or for your Java engine, you actually need memory pages that are both writable and executable, which leads to other problems. But nevertheless, it's a very strong protection that enforces the code integrity for the code that is protected that way. And let's see how it actually fits into the memory model. So it completely closes this attack vector on the very left-hand side where an attacker can overwrite code in memory or add additional code in memory and completely protects us from this code corruption attack. And the only thing that remains is a control flow hijack attack or a data-only attack. But, well, we've got other defenses, right? So let's look at those as well. We've got address-based layout randomization that has been called has been introduced as a new and very powerful safety mechanism. And the idea is that it randomizes the locations of code and data regions all throughout the memory whenever you restart a program. And this is a probabilistic defense. And it depends on the load ramp, both the OS as well. A problem is that even though the attacker needs to find the location, this is actually not too hard, because many applications contain some information leak and will tell you the pointer of a specific object. For example, old JavaScript implementations returned the address of the object if you just asked for the hash value of the object, because that's kind of a unique value, right? And there are a whole bunch of these information leaks out there that can be exploited to gain additional information. So address-based layout randomization and other randomization techniques, all these probabilistic techniques, are very prone to information leaks. So instead of a one-shot attack, where you can attack the program or the application in one go, you get a two-shot attack. So you first have to gain information about the application, and then you can exploit it in the second step. And that's still not too hard, right? Maybe you have to find two bugs, but that's still doable. And in addition, at least on x86, a large set of code locations remain static. Otherwise, you would get a more than 10% performance impact. So the current Linux ASLR implementation still has large static control blocks for the main executable itself, for example. And if we would randomize that part as well, we would see a huge increase in performance overhead of more than 10% on average. And all the libraries, they're already compiled as position-independent code. So the performance overhead comes from using an additional register for relocatable code. So if you have code that can be placed at any location in memory, you need to keep one register as a site that always keeps the base pointer of the current code segment so that you can jump around in that code segment. If everything is at a static address, like for the main executable, then you're fine because you don't need to keep that extra register. So if we tell the if you tell GCC to actually compile the code as relocatable, we see that for these spec CPU benchmarks that I've shown here, you get a 10% performance degradation, which is almost too costly for a security mechanism. So if we summarize this address-based layout randomization protection that we've got here, then we can see that, yeah, we've got some protection against the different forms of randomization. So both the locations of code gets randomized and the locations of data gets randomized. And both of those are scrambled around, and it's harder for an attacker to circumvent it. As soon as the attacker learns the secret, so let's say you're attacking an Apache server and you crashed one thread and you got the information about the memory layout, you can use that information on the second thread because it's only randomized for each process, but not for each thread. The last security mechanism that's out there are stack canaries, which protect the return instruction pointer on the stack. And it's a compiler-based modification, and the compiler changes the stack layout during the compilation. It's also probabilistic protection, as the compiler places a secret cookie next to a buffer that could be overrun by some missing integrity checks. And again, it's probabilistic. As soon as the attacker knows that cookie, the attacker can place that cookie and in the exploit and just circumvent the protection easily. Or the attacker can use a directed write if it's not a continuous buffer overflow and circumvent the stack cookie that way. So there's no protection against targeted reads or writes. But again, if we look into our model, we see that these stack cookies protect a subset of all code pointers, namely the return instruction pointers, with a very weak probabilistic protection. And that's basically all we have. So we don't have any protection against memory safety corruption or memory safety errors. And we only have very limited and partial protection against any integrity violations. So we do have code integrity, which is a very good thing and can be used to actually build up much stronger defenses on top of it. But we don't have code pointer integrity that is effective against any randomization attacks or other possible attacks. And we don't have any data integrity either. Randomization is partially implemented. We do have address-based layout randomization. But there are also a bunch of other randomization schemes that have been proposed in academia. A drawback of those is that many have a higher performance overhead of 20 or more percent. And we don't have any control flow or data flow integrity solutions that are implemented in this current system. So if we look at the model and combine all the different defenses that we have, we see that, well, we have code corruption protection, which is a good thing. We have stack canaries that somehow protect the return instruction pointers on the stack, which is not too bad, right? It's at least something, and it's cheap. And we have ASLR, which randomizes the locations of code and data throughout the application. So we do. It looks like we have a decent protection, right? But all of these security mechanisms, even if used in combinations, can still be circumvented by using techniques like return-oriented programming. And well, it looks like the defense mechanisms that we are using on current systems are just not enough. And we need to come up with something that's better and that's stronger than what we already have. So you might ask, why did these stronger defenses fail? We have more than 100 different alternatives that we could just implement right away. But all of them failed due to a couple of reasons, or have not been used due to a couple of reasons. Well, first of all, they have too much overhead. if a defense mechanism has more than 10% overhead, or even if they have 10% overhead, they're not going to be used in the wild, right? You're already using a C compiler, and you're so happy if your C compiler gets a 2% performance improvement, then you're not going to give up like 200% just to run it with a type-safe version. Otherwise, you would have implemented your software in a type-safe language in the first place. Or the next option is that many of these defense mechanisms lose compatibility to legacy and source code. So many systems need to have a static compilation. For example, most of these control flow integrity solutions, they need to see all the code at compile time, which leads to a statically executable, statically compiled executable. And this is just not feasible together with shared library support. In addition, a whole bunch of defense mechanisms rely on source code modifications. And if you have 200 million lines of code, you're not going to rewrite them in a safe language of another safe version of your programming language. And the last step, or the last reason why they have not been adopted, is strong defense mechanisms need to have effectiveness against a large set of attacks, and they need to protect against complete classes of attacks, and not just against a tiny little version of it. So to summarize, defense mechanism must be cheap, they must be compatible to legacy and source code, and they should be effective. So where do we go from now? What kind of options do we have? We've seen that attackers are still more powerful than defenders, and defense mechanisms have a hard time of getting adopted and working in the first place. So there are several approaches that we can do. We can change the compiler. We can change the language itself. Or we can change the runtime system. And let's quickly discuss these three options one after the other. So memory safety, or having memory safety, would be an awesome treat to protect our software. Unfortunately, if we just run softbounds together with CATS, which gives us some strong form of memory safety for C and C++ programs, we see that we have a performance overhead of up to 250%, which is way too much to run for commodity software. Imagine running your browser with a 250% overhead. But what we can do is we can try to enforce memory safety for some pointers, just a subset of the pointers. Maybe not for all data, but if we can somehow select the amount of data that we actually want to protect, we could offer strong protection for this subset of data without taking control and protecting all the data that is out there, which will just lead to too much overhead. And, well, maybe compiler analysis will help. There will definitely be some tricky engineering to make it work, especially with shared libraries that should be supported and so on. So we'll definitely need to look into that. And we can also use a safe runtime system. So some form of secure execution platform that must support legacy code and binary code itself. One possible solution will be binary translation that translates the application as we go along and kind of detects what kind of data pointers are important, what kind of data regions are used for control flow transfers, and then protects these data locations using additional steps on top of it. And we can leverage the runtime information, dynamically collect the information, which enables us more preciser security checks on top of it. So what we can do on a high level, we can wrap the running application into a secure runtime platform that kind of collects information as the application goes along, and then enforces that information, but just for the privileged data locations that we want to protect, and not for all the data locations that are out there. So we have the little sandbox that wraps the application, and we can control the interaction. We can rely on the information that is available from the loader, so we can infer some form of control flow integrity policy by just extracting all the information that the loader provides us. So all the different different symbol tables can be used to restrict and refine the possible allowed targets in the, for the control flow transfers that are executed inside the sandbox. And we can also check the interaction with the system. If you guys don't know what binary translation is, I want to give you a quick highlight. Instead of executing the original code, we add a small virtualization system on top of it and virtualize it in one additional step. So code is not executed on the bare-bone hardware, but we actually compile code as we go along in a just-in-time compilation process that dynamically checks the targets and origins, gets the information from the loader, refines that information, and adds a whole bunch of additional security checks into the protected code that is then executed on the real hardware. And therefore, we can enforce some form of dynamic security policy on top of it without too much overhead. And we'll actually see how far we can go with that approach, or if we have to tap into the compiler information as well. So what did we learn? How far did we come? What will be the result of all of this? Well, first of all, low-level languages are here to stay. We've seen that even nowadays, a whole bunch of software projects are started and newly started in these low-level languages. And we need protection against all different forms of memory vulnerabilities. And we need to adhere to the performance characteristics. We need to support the legacy code that's out there. We cannot allow source code changes. And we have to be compatible with a large set of other options. So we can try to protect against the biggest attack vector that is out there nowadays, and we have to find a form to mitigate against these control flow hijack attacks. And a secure execution platform is one start, but then we'll have to follow up to the next levels and adapt and change our compilers as well to get protection that is stronger than what we already have. And we have to rethink the existing security defense mechanisms that are rolled out nowadays, especially things like stack canaries that only add little protection on top of it. And we might better spend these 1 or 2% performance overhead into other instructions that can implement a stronger security policy on top of it. And future directions after that, if we've protected against control flow hijack attack, then there are still data attacks out there. And data attacks are a completely different problem that we'll have to tackle. So I strongly believe that we can fix control flow hijack attacks pretty soon, but we'll still have to look into all the data attacks that are out there. But I want to end this talk with that, well, if the winning move is not to play, then maybe we need to change the rules of the game. We are the first software that ever runs, so we can actually constrain the system in additional ways and change the rules of the game, add additional security defense mechanisms that are stronger and protect the software from being exploited. And with that, I would like to thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thanks, Matthias, for that really great overview. So the microphones are two on the left and the right, and then we'll also take questions from the internet. Let's start with microphone number two.
Hello. It was a great talk. I kind of got two questions. One of them is you're saying that we should look at moving things like Java because that's a safer language, but everyone is now seems to be saying, get Java off your system, don't use it, because the number of exploits. So we're confronted with these mixed messages, and and the other question I've got is, whenever I see memory errors discussed, they always discuss the stack. People mutter about heap exploits, but I never see an example of one, so I have no idea how one would work. And I can only see that heap exploits would work by modifying something on the heap, and then the program would read that onto the stack, and then you'd have a stack exploit. Is there a way to directly exploit the heap? And if there isn't, would simply persuading people to read all user data into the heap rather than the stack harden a lot of programming in low-level languages or not?
Let me answer your first question first. It's not Java as in the language that gets exploited. It's Java as in the crappy browser plugin that gets exploited. There's a whole bunch of fairly secure Java software that runs on the server side. And that one is perfectly secure. But the Java plugin itself that runs in nowadays browsers is very insecure. And this plugin is actually written in a low-level language. Most of the Java virtual machine is written in C. And the attacks happen against this this virtual machine and try to exploit the virtual machine. The attacker supplies the Java code and breaks the virtual machine. But on the other hand, on the server systems, where Java runs perfectly safe, the Java version runs a large, let's say, a data processing engine or something like that, and the attacker can only supply data, but not code. And then it's perfectly fine. And well, you still have all these problems with low-level languages like C or C++ that you can attack the data path of the application.
But how does that work on the heap? Because no one ever demonstrates how that works. I'd like to know how do heap exploits work. Because everyone always says they're there, but I never see an example of one.
Well,
it's always
one possible way for a heap exploit are the classic use after free exploits, where you change some specific data structures. And well, one easy heap exploit could be you have you're writing in C++, you have your object somewhere on the stack. That object is freed, and another object is allocated on top of it. But you still get control over one field of the old object because a pointer points in there. And conveniently, this pointer points to the vtable pointer of the new object. And you can then overwrite that vtable pointer. And as soon as that object is used in the context of the application, the attacker-controlled vtable pointer will be followed, and some attacker-controlled code will be executed. And you didn't have to push anything onto the stack. It's all on a heap. That would be an example, right?
Okay, yeah. That's exactly what I was looking for, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, next question from the microphone behind.
Hi. I got a question concerning the 250% performance trade-off. From what I understood, this trade-off comes from additional checks those compiler extensions put into your code. But those additional checks, shouldn't they have been in your original code in the first place?
Well, address sanitizer and softpounds plus CTS that implement those checks, they have to be very conservative. They usually run the analysis on a per function basis, and they have to instrument every single access that you do. You as a programmer, you can actually think about, oh, well, the attacker will never be able to supply these and these values, and the values will only be between 1 and 10. If you know that for sure, because the function that you use, the caller, actually just uses static values. Right, so you can actually use inherent knowledge in between the caller and the callee to remove stacks as a programmer. And the software-based approach or compiler-based approach has to be conservative and has to add all the checks. In addition, the C language is very diverse, so you have a large set of different options that you can add that make all the analysis much, much harder.
Okay, I kind of anticipated that answer. but isn't this exactly kind of the problem? I mean, the programmer thinking that at this point the code can't be exploited, but
maybe the code is reused somewhere else and the assumptions or the assumptions change and then you're screwed.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what happens.
Okay.
All right, now we take a question from the internet.
So first question from the internet is, do new version of C and C++ provide necessary protection mechanism or language constructs to prevent common attacks like you mentioned? I think you covered a little bit of that at the beginning of your talk, but if you could expand.
Can you repeat the question?
Okay, please? The question is, do new version of C and C++ provide necessary protection mechanism or language constructs to prevent common attacks?
To prevent what attacks?
Common attacks.
Common?
Common.
Okay. No, they don't.
Short answer.
You can use tools like Address Sanitizer or a whole bunch of other analysis tools that run on top of it. Or you can use Softbounds and CTS, which is also a compiler extension. And these tools basically use liberties in the language specification to actually inject additional security checks on top of it. But most of these tools, like in the academic papers, these tools are advertised as usually advertised as debugging tools, just because they have so much or such a huge overhead. You can definitely, if you want safe software, you can recompile it with softbounds, and then you should be good to go, right? But you will hit a huge performance impact.
All right. All right, another question for microphone two, please.
Yes, hello, good talk. I have a question, this GR security kernel patches, how does it fit into this picture?
Mm-hmm. So the GR security patches, they are a bunch of hardening patches against the kernel and kernel modifications itself. So that would be kind of a source code-based approach to actually harden the software itself. I guess they also have, they implement a whole bunch of defense mechanism, right? So they introduced ASLR, right? I guess so, yeah. Even before it was in the mainline kernel. So they have multiple roles, right? So they add new security defense mechanism for user land, they make exploitation of the kernel itself harder. It's a nice project. But it's not the language-based. They program in C, and they add all these nice security features. So it's a good thing.
Well, we got another question from the second microphone, going to number two.
Hi, thanks for the great talk. I was wondering, what's your opinion on the secure functions that Microsoft has implemented from the C standard, like string copy S and that family of functions?
Well. It's still C, right? You can make your mistakes somewhere else and not just there.
That's true, but do you feel that it adds any protection, like that a programmer would be less likely to make a mistake using these functions?
Well, it's definitely better than the non-secure version, but the question is how much better is it?
Right.
Or it might solve a small set of problems, but then there are others that are still in there. So it's a very debatable question.
All right, thanks.
And it was an easy fix that they could add very quickly, but it's not a thorough fix that will save the inherent problem of these low-level languages, especially as it only fixes like a couple of functions.
All right, I think we had another question from the internet.
There are two more questions. The first one is, are you aware of the existence of Muscle libc for Linux, which makes
static
link.
Say again, what libc?
Muscle libc, MUSL, which makes static linking feasible.
Yeah, there are a bunch of libcs that are statically linkable. Yeah, there. But the standard, the eglibc is not.
Okay. Next question is, if you compile all your programs for yourself with a custom set of C flags or presumably LD flags as well. Would you consider your binaries secure because no one else knows the exact libc address?
That's the same problem, right? As soon as you have an information leak off, like I assume the application that you compile yourself processes input and output, and well, if you get the binary, you can reverse that one, or yeah, it's it's still C, right?
Well, before we wrap up this talk, I would just like to remind everyone to provide feedback. We can only improve these presentations if we get feedback. Also, it helps the speakers a lot. So please go online, provide the feedback. And with that, I would like to thank Matthias for that really comprehensive overview of this problem class in security. Thank you very much, Matthias.
Thanks.